Pretty dry sometimes. So what's so wonderful about crossing traditions is that we can benefit from the wisdoms and the compassions of many Buddhas. You know, in the Vajragata Sutta, Vajragata asked the Buddha, was he the only one that attained enlightenment? He said, oh no, Vajragata, I have many monks who have attained, and many female monks who have attained, and many male householders who have attained, and many female householders who have attained. Vajragata said, oh great, great, because if it was only you, I didn't want to get in this. And so it's like that. We have to think that, yes, there is one who has given us great wisdom and guidance, but we have to look at where he was pointing. That finger points to something. And he says, it doesn't point to me. We talk about taking refuge in the Buddha. We are setting ourselves up for having some confidence in his teachings, that's for sure. But he says, just don't do it because I said it. Don't do it because it's written in the holy books. Don't do it because people have said that this is what you've done. But take it all. Put it into the cauldron of your experience. And when you know for yourself that this leads to peace, then you do that. When you know for yourself that this is beneficial, that this is good, it leads to my happiness and the happiness of others, then you do that thing. And so he taught with an open hand and not with any compulsion that we must accept any teaching that he gave, but that we should put it all to the test in our own life and cleave to that which we have found to be good. And in this way he said, you become a light to your own feet and a lamp unto your own path. So that's the beauty of the liberty of being able to investigate and come to know what is reality, what is real. And you know, reality, the thing about reality is that we see it from our side. One time someone asked the Buddha, is there a God? And he said yes, and he asked another guy asked him, he said no. And so his student Ananda said, well, you drive me crazy, is it or isn't it? He said, to the one that believes it is, there is, and the one that believes there isn't, it isn't. And so you see, we create a reality based on our own conceptual awareness. And if we keep refining our awareness, deepening our awareness, penetrating beyond what the senses tell us, and he includes consciousness and thoughts as part of our sensory equipment. You know, our eyes can fool us. Our eyes can trick us. Our thoughts do delude us. And he says you can't rely totally on them. So you take everything you see with a grain of salt, everything you hear, and everything you experience. And you can experience something today, and a year later, that same thing, but you know it altogether in a different way because of how you may have grown in that period of time, or how you may have been wounded in that period of time. It causes you to see it differently. And so he says, yes, to a certain point, we must rely. Internal base meets external base. Consciousness arises. I know what that is. And the three of those things make contact. With contact comes a feeling. I like it. You know, it's a pleasant feeling, unpleasant feeling, or neutral feeling. And with that feeling comes a craving or an aversion. If I like it, it's a craving for more. I want it to stay around. I want it to be permanent. If it's a unpleasant feeling, we have an aversion to it. I want it to go away. I don't want it to be here. I don't want to accept the truth of it. And if it's a neutral feeling, like we don't really care, you know, not bothering me. You can stay or you can go. It's like that. And so he said, and he said, what that is what causes our suffering. This wanting what we like or what we love or what we find confident or what we find security in to be permanent. But all things are impermanent. And so wanting them to be permanent sets us up for the downfall. It sets us up for the suffering. Then he said, so if we break that chain, right there, that link of craving, then we find contentment in life. That means when it's good, enjoy it. And when it's gone, it's gone. You know, and that's how we have to begin to retrain our minds. From the time we were children, we were encouraged to develop certain tendencies. We are basically steered towards delighting in certain things and expressing our pleasure and our joy. And that part's okay. But it's the expectation that it will be there forever. You know, and even when we know that it's not, we know that everybody dies. We know these things, but yet we're not ready for it because up until the moment that it happens, it's not really real. We're not really prepared. We're not saying, every day I bury my children. In my mind's eye, every day. Every day, my closest friends, I lay them down in a coffin every day. Every day I die. Because I'm preparing for the inevitable. If I outlive them, they will die before me. And I will have to deal with that separation. And it can be painful, or I can have developed a tendency to see it as it is. All of our loved ones die. There's no way to avoid it. When I was becoming a nun, I asked my husband, I've been married to my third husband for 28 years. And, you know, after 28 years, a long time. Our children were now grown, and life was good, you know. Everything, Coco said, everything perfect. But yet there was this sense of urgency, that something that had been with me since I was a child that I had not brought fruition to, and time was getting short. And at that time I had an illness. I had like a kidney deficiency, and we thought I was going to have to go on dialysis. And I was filled with so much regret, because I thought that I would die and not have accomplished something that was deep in my heart to come before I got, you know, all the degrees, before I had all the businesses, before I started making all the money, before I had all my lovers. There was something that I came here with that I had not really borne witness to, partly because I don't know how I got in the family I was in, but they didn't understand me. They didn't understand this this spiritual drive that I had. They didn't understand this connection. And sometimes what people don't understand, they are afraid of. So they would stop me from going to church. You know, they would lock me in my room. My brother would come around to the window and rescue me, you know, and take me out the window and sneak me out to church. And if we got back before they found out, all things good. You know, if we didn't, we got beat. So it was like this for so long, until my mother just gave up. You know, but later I began to realize it was her own guilt. You know, it pointed to her guilt, my going to church and the things that I was sharing. And she was living a different kind of life, and she didn't understand the causes that had produced the condition of her life. And when she came down to the end of her life, I could explain it all to her, because I had learned it. I could share it with her. And her last days were her best days. My mother was came from a family of sharecroppers in North Carolina. And she was sold to the master of the plantation when she was 13. She was fair-skinned and red-haired, and the rest of her sisters and brothers were dark, and he wanted her. And her mother had 13 children, and he said to her, "You give me this one, and I'll take care of all of your children." And so even though her mother hated to do it, she did it to be able to care for her other children. And in those days, we didn't really have a lot of choice about what happened to us. And so from the having of those children to the selling of that one daughter to the plantation owner, didn't have much choice. But it made my mother feel a deep, deep rejection that she was the only one. And she carried that with her throughout her life. She never got over it. And she worked hard to attain and to achieve, to be better than any of the other sisters and brothers. And at the end of her mother's life, she was the one who took care of her, not these sisters and brothers who stayed with her. But yet and still, she felt deficient inside. She never said, "I love you," to any of her children until she was on her deathbed. She couldn't say it. And it hurt me so. I was 55 when she finally said. And she didn't actually say, "I love you." I was telling her how much I loved her. And she said, "Me too." And that's the closest she could get. That's the closest she could get to it, you know. But that was enough for me. I never recall sitting on my mother's lap. But I did sit on my father's lap. I had a father, and he loved me. And he taught me how to love, even when it didn't seem like I was being loved in return. That the giving of love is enough. It's enough for both sides, the giving of love. And so this was our life growing up. But she did, and she worked three jobs so that she could send all of her children to college. And what happened was her way of escape was some family members got together and got her some money to get on a bus. And they said, "Take this and go as far as you can go with this money." The bus went as far as D.C. before her money ran out. That's how she ended up in D.C., 13 years old, no family, nothing. And she met a man who had come also from North Carolina sometime later, and they began to have a family. Now, at some point, he decided to go, and I'm going somewhere with this story. At some point, he decided to leave. He took the kids. I wasn't born yet, but he took them to the bus station, bought everybody an ice cream cone, and said, "Wait right here, I'll be right back." And he never came back. The youngest sister was fair like my mother. He sold her to somebody. So the police, when the station was closing, the police took all the kids. My mother got off from work. She worked at a Chinese laundry, and she went looking for her children, and she couldn't find them. And then the police came to the house. And they said, "You have to show us that you can take care of these kids to get them back." But on her salary alone at the Chinese laundry, she couldn't show enough income. So they were put into a foundling home. She met my father. My father was a gigolo. He's a male prostitute, my father. And he owned a brothel, a boarding house. He was born in 1900, my father. So I was an old baby. He was born in 1900, never had any children. He made his money running bootleg liquor in the 20s, and you know, and he lived a rough life. And he helped my mother. She was half his age. This is a story, isn't it? He helped my mother. She was half his age. And when this happened, he went and he got her children, all six of her children. And he married her. And he gave up that way of life to be a father to her children. And he said, "I never thought I would have an opportunity to live a life like this. I never thought I'd have anyone that loved me." And so he raised her six children. And a couple of years later, I came along. So I was sort of like an accident, you know. He was old. But here, he had a child, his own child, in his old age. And it was so wonderful. So the end of his life was good, you know. The end of her life was good. And my life was good. In spite of all of the terror that was there. In spite of everything. And so there was something in me coming into being. You know, there is the egg and there is the sperm. But there's also the gandhava, the consciousness that meets. And these three produce a being. And when there's just the egg and the sperm and there's no consciousness, it passes out. But when that rebirth linking consciousness finds a host and it takes up residence, and produces. And here I am. So I come in not just like my father, not just with the DNA of my mother, but I am the fruit of this rebirth living consciousness. So I have a different way of thinking, a different way of acting. I have a different view. It's nothing like my mother's. It's nothing like my father's. And here I am, you know, like a gift to them, maybe. So I'm born in a strange family. I don't really fit. But yet, I am the fruit of some action that was started. And now I'm born, and I am the fruit of that. So that helps me to know that whatever I do in this life, if I finish it and the fruit comes, I will get it. I will eat it, be it good fruit or be it rotten fruit. But if I die before I do, I've set it in motion already. And that fruit will bear fruit. There will be some becoming, some being that will inherit that fruit the same way I inherited some other being's fruit. That's how I got to be here. And so I try to make sure that what I do, just in case I don't get all of the fruit, and someone else, or something else, has to be the recipient of that fruit, that it will be good fruit. That's why I don't need the reward of a heaven to work good in this life. It is good enough for me to know that I'm planting good seed. And whoever is the inheritor of that seed will say, how fortunate a birth I have. And this is my story. And this is what motivates me to deeply understand how life is and how life unfolds. And so I wanted to share with you this story, because we each have a story. You know, my story is not unique. Everybody in here can probably tell a story that needs to be made into a movie. So it's not really about the story, but it's really more about seeing, you know, the commonality of the issues of life. And Buddha said that when we get to looking at this and talking about this, we'll find out dukkha, everything is dukkha, everything is suffering. There is the truth of suffering in conditioned reality. Because everything is impermanent. And because nothing is self. There is really no me, my, or mine. Not really. Because if it was mine, I could keep it as long as I want. If it was me, this body wouldn't have diabetes. If there is nothing that is totally in my control, therefore, I am the possessor inherently of nothing, not even my own being, not even my own body, not even my own thoughts. You know, the mind is very much like a receiver. You tune it to a certain frequency, you get what's on that frequency. So sometimes we think in certain thoughts, they're not even our thoughts. They're somebody else's, but we've like tapped in on that frequency. And we get it. Sometimes when I'm meditating, I tap in on some frequency and I hear the news. I hear television. I hear radio. Sometimes quirky things happen when you meditate. But it's true. It's like that. You know, for yourself, you can step into an elevator and two people have been arguing. You know, but when you step in, they're looking straight ahead and like everything's okay. You feel it. You feel it in the elevator, you know. Or if you have teenage kids, you know, and they're downstairs listening to music with their friends, you go downstairs and one sitting over here, one sitting over here, but the air just doesn't feel quite right, you know. That before you came down, they were not here and here, you know. And so it's these things, these ways that we can know things. And he said the only reason we don't is because our senses are dull. We haven't fine-tuned ourselves. And he gives us techniques on how to fine-tune ourselves, how to center ourselves, how to settle ourselves down like a clear, flat lake. He said, this kind of lake that you could look in and you could see pebbles and you could see sand and you could see shoals of fish swimming, just so the mind can be stilled like that. But if the mind is stirred up and you're stirring up the soil on the bottom of the lake, I mean, it's muddy and you can't see anything. And it's not because those things are not there, and it's not because they can be seen, but you can't see because your own mind, not because they're not there or because they're not visible. And so he encourages us to develop the skillfulness to still the mind so that we can clearly perceive what is perceivable, not just through the senses, but for the senses to be the portal to even moving beyond our run-of-the-mill, ordinary sensibilities and beyond our conceptual awarenesses. So it's not the end of a process. The meditation is like the road. You know, I was like that song, Do You Know the Way to San Jose? Well, the meditation is like being on that road. But the road is not the destination. No. You just travel the road. But the destination exists on its own, whether you get there or not, or whether you travel that road or not. But you could travel another road, and that road doesn't go to San Jose. You can walk that road, and you'll never get there. And so he says, don't get caught up in the road, but get to the destination. There is somewhere to go. There is something to do. And the paradox is that we get there by being still. We go there by being here now. This brightness, this crystal clear awareness. The scientists tell us we use maybe 3 to 6% of our brain power. So we don't have to take it to supernatural, supernormal. If we just got to being fully human, it would be sufficient. It would be enough. And so this is what he was teaching his disciples, how to be fully human and skillful so that they could be fit for every good use, so that they can be a present help in the time of need. So I wanted to give you I wanted to take you through a meditation technique. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes. I want to take you through a meditation technique today. And I wanted this to be experiential. So we'll have a few minutes to talk about what we may be experiencing or what we may. A lot of times we think about meditation like a little folding of the hands, you know, a little getting squishy and soft, just relaxing and just really go away for a while, you know, but it's really not like that. Even though in an outer sense we are still, in the inner sense we are arousing energy. We're really moving from a beta state to an alpha state, a heightened awareness. And yet we are holding that heightened awareness in a very still container so that we're not stirring up things, but we're able to peer in and see clearly. We're learning how to sharpen our vision, to sharpen our hearing, to deepen our understanding, to just let the scales of ignorance drop away by themselves, and we see something that we didn't see before because the mind is still. The mind is steady. And so I want to talk about the four Brahma Viharas, since we sang about them today. Metta, Karuna, Mudita. What's the last one? Come on.
Becca.
Okay. That just means loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, or joy in the successes of others. And that's really, really big. That's the get you over one right there, you know, because I may get something, you know, but today might not be my day, but if it's your day, you got something. And I have take joy in your success. I got it today, too, you know. It's like when I went out and I saw your grounds here, you know, and it was like just so beautiful to me, you know. It was like a children's paradise or something, you know. And I was so happy, just as if it was my own. A woman in my church got a Cadillac. I think she got a Mercedes. But when she got the Mercedes, everybody in church got mad with her. Who she thinks she is? And, you know, I mean, what a nice car. And how can she afford that? And, you know, all of that went on, you know. You know, in these loving environments we come together in. And but when I saw her car, it was as if I had gotten it myself. And it's different with my car. I was so happy for her. And she wasn't even nice to me. You know? And that's why it was so meaningful to her, because she knew how mean she was to me. You know? But I really rejoiced for her. You know? It was shortly after that I needed a car. I had $500. So you know what kind of car I was going to get. So I go to the Senate Dodge. I don't even make Dodges anymore, do they? They do?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So I went to Senate Dodge, and I was going to get a clunker with this $500. The man said, how much money do you have? I said, he said, go and look on the lot to get it and see whatever you like. You know, you can have anything you like on the lot. That's what he said. So my brother had taken me, and we've gone, and we looked on the lot, and I saw this red Cadillac with white interior. It was beautiful. It was beautiful. It looked brand new to me. It wasn't brand new, but it had been excellently maintained. And I said, oh, John, I would really like that car. He said, well, then get that one. I said, John, I have $500. He said, the man said you can have anything you want. I said, yeah, but he didn't mean this one. You know? He said, well, you don't know. Go ask him what he meant. So we go back in, and I'm too ashamed to even pose that question, because you know the answer's no. You can know it's no. You don't need somebody to tell you no. You know? So I didn't want to ask him. And he said, ask him. So I said, well, I saw a car that I did like. It's the Cadillac. He said, how much do you have? I said, $500. He said, sold, I'll take it. And you know, he gave me that car. What I didn't know was that the next day, their car dealership was filing bankruptcy. And they were just letting everything go out for whatever they could get the day before they died. Now, I found that out a week later when I read it in the paper, you know. But that's how I got it. You know, but it doesn't matter how I got it. It's the fact that I got it, you know. And so, but I truly believe that that was the fruit of the planting of my rejoicing when this woman got her car. You know? Yeah, that might be my reality, my truth, but that's what I truly believe, you know. And so I make a practice of doing these things. You know, if I really need something, you know, I don't worry about it. Because I know how I'm going to treat other people. I don't worry about it. And if I don't get it, well, you know, I gave it a good try. You know, I was hopeful for it. But I don't have it. That's all. It's like that. And I can't say, well, I didn't need it anyway. Sometimes I don't get something that I really need, you know. But life ain't fair. It just is what it is. And so we take this attitude, never stop giving, even when the fruit doesn't come back right away. Sometimes it comes back in many days, and it may not even come back in your lifetime. But you cast it out there. You planted it. There will be the watering. There will be the sunshine. There will be an increase. You may inherit it, you may not. And this is how the Buddha helps us understand how life keeps going on and on and on, and how we come into being. So, now getting back to the meditation. And, you know, I was a Pentecostal preacher, so sometimes I can really get long-winded. I'll start with one story and I'll end up with another one. But they're all good. So the Brahma Viharas is developing a certain state of mind. We call them the heavenly abodes, you know. And you don't, there is two ways of looking at this, but I'm going to keep it on the mundane, earthly way of looking at it for you today. Sitch told me mostly your new practitioners, so I don't want to go too deep, but I'm going to just keep it on a comfortable level for you today. So this cultivating loving kindness, you know, may I be well and happy and peaceful. Those are really sweet words, you know, but we have to go deep to really wish wellness on ourselves and happiness on ourselves, peacefulness on ourselves. Some of us feel like my mother, that she didn't deserve it because she had been soiled when she was a child. And even though she did her best to make up for it in her own eyes, she was never good enough. So sometimes we have to go deep and see, even when someone has hurt us and they never came back and said, I'm sorry, will you forgive me? Her mother never said that to her. And we couldn't even call her grandma. We had to call her Miss Alice. Because she even didn't want to associate with a daughter that she had put in that position. Because she couldn't deal with the shame of what she had done as a mother. You see? And so these things run back and back and back. That's why I ask how did this come about? What is unfolding right now? And if we ask how, we will start to see something. What makes people do the things they do, think the way they think, act the way they act, and a pity can arise for them. To know that to do this horrible thing to someone, you know, there must have been something in your life that happened that made that seem the only option for you. And so at the end of my mother's life, she told me this story. We didn't know the story in the beginning. She told it at the end. And she said, please don't write it down before I die. I don't want anyone to know. And so we have to learn how to apply a salve of loving kindness to ourselves for ourselves. There are some people that we have encountered who did something to hurt us, to wound us. And they have regret, but they've gone away. They don't even know where you are. Or maybe they have a different way, a different view, you know. And it doesn't matter now. You know, I was raped, and I hardly remember it. As a matter of fact, it just came up for me just now. You know, because I hardly even remember it. I so forgave that guy. He became, as a result of that incident, because he was a friend of my boyfriend's, and he put something in my drink. And my boyfriend had gone to another party. He said, I'll take care of her, and I'll get her home. And he drugged me, and he raped me. And then my boyfriend rejected me because that was his best friend. And it hurt me so deeply, you know. But some years later, I ran into him again. And he had become a psychiatrist. And he sought me out to ask my forgiveness. And he said, and I went to Pharaoh and I told him what I had done. And how I had betrayed his trust as a friend, and how I had ravaged you. And the fact that he could own up to it. But I said to him, I said, you know, I forgave you a long time ago. Because that's the only way I could go. I forgave you a long time ago. And for me, it's like it never happened. You know? He did something with my body. What is this body? Earth, water, fire, air, space. That's it. He did something with those elements. And I forgave him. And so we have to rouse a deep loving kindness like this for oneself first, and then for others. And when we sit with this for a while, he says a great compassion arises. You can't get into compassion without loving kindness. That is the doorway. If you think you have compassion and haven't passed the loving kindness gate, it's not there. This is the doorway. It ushers you into it. So the fruit of loving kindness is a heart of compassion. It's a naturally arising fragrance. It's a deep seed that can look into a person's eyes and see down into their heart. That can overlook small faults and big ones. And when your compassion is ripened, you spontaneously pass through the portal to mudita, joy in the successes of others. Even when people would win, when I was in business and beat me out, you know, I still rejoiced that they got it. You know, maybe he was shrewder than I was. You know, maybe he had more financial contacts than I did. Whatever. He won. I was happy. I was happy for him. I said, maybe next time. A lot of times the next time came around. I was trying to get a house. A rooming house I wanted to buy. And I offered a good price for it. You know, not just based on the real estate, but based on the return on investment I would get from renting out the room. So it was more than what the house was worth already. You know, the guy turned my offer down. Somebody else got it. I was happy for him. 6 months later, turns out he was an alcoholic and the bank took it back. And instead of me buying it for $120,000, I got it for $48,000. You know, I guess he had put up whatever the difference is in $48,000 and $120,000 in cash, and there was a note of $48,000 and the bank didn't want it. They didn't want to deal with tenants. They said, just give me what he owes and it's yours. You know, so I learned never to be upset if I don't get something when I want it at this time. Maybe something will come along better. Maybe I'll get it later. Whatever. We'll just see. You know? And then you can go through life easy this way. I'm just talking now about taking responsibility for our life on a daily basis and not looking for our prayers or for our meditation or anything else, you know, to give that to us. But it's a step-by-step way that we condition our mind and we see through kindly eyes for our own happiness. And so this joy in the successes of others naturally flowers. And the thing is that once this starts to operate in your life, you don't really worry about anything, no matter how bad it is. Someone asked me today, how could you be thinking about going to Thailand when they're talking about posting soldiers outside of your nun's doors? Aren't you afraid to go there? I'm not afraid to go there. It may cost me my life. I sure hope not. You know, because I don't like pain any more than the next person. You know, I'm not afraid to die. It's just the pain I don't want to deal with. You know, if you're going to kill me quick. It's my hope. Yeah, and I'm being a little bit flip about it, but you know, I can tell you truthfully, at this moment, there is no fear present, you know, and so I can go. If fear was present, I'd have to think about whether, you know, I could really handle it or not. But how could you participate in setting these women into this space? And then when a hardship comes, say, oops, my bad. go. You know, so it's not even a consideration about whether or not I'll go. I will go. And hope for the best. I do. But going through life fearlessly like this is a naturally arising fruit of equanimity. You get into this place where you just let things be. And a certain bravery emerges that you can handle the hard things in your life. So knowing this, we can go into a meditation with this kind of heart, with this kind of strength, with this kind of realization, we sit. And so he says that we should gladden ourselves in this way before we sit down to meditate. You know, we come into meditation dragged because I had a horrible day. Boy, do I need to meditate. And if we sit there, we won't be able to see the forest for the trees. No, he says, but we have to build ourselves up, perch ourselves up on the pinnacle, and then we sit. And when we do, we can, like, just peruse the forest perched from this high place. And that's what's called entering into the Brahma Vihara. So he said, gladden yourself with this truth. And then we take an object of or subject of meditation. The Buddha taught about 40 different subjects, and that's not all there were. It wasn't like this, 40 and no more. Anything can be a subject of meditation, object of meditation. Anything from intermittent traffic, like following the car as it goes by and just waiting. You know, and when the next one comes by, following it until the sound is gone and it's waiting. You can take something. If you're in a place where it's noisy, you can make that your object of meditation. It could be the hum of the fan as your object. It could be your heartbeat object of meditation. It could be the thought of peace or joy or love as your subject of meditation. You can take anything. But pick something. You can use the breath. But when you use the breath, you know, it's not like the whole breath moving, because the object is to get still and stationary. So the instruction is like a sawyer places his eyes right where the blade meets the wood. And as he saws, his eye never leaves right there. He doesn't follow the whole blade and back. His eyes stay right there where the blade meets the wood. And he said that when we focus on our breath, it should be like that. Just pick a spot. Anywhere. It can be in the nose, outside the nose, on the tip of the tongue. Anywhere. It can be down here, anywhere. But just pick a spot. And that whole body of breath, examine it, stick with it only as it crosses that one spot. That's the simile of a song. Okay. So pick an object of meditation for yourself. He said, quite secluded. Secluded from what? You gonna go off in the woods every time you get ready to meditate? No, quite secluded from unwholesome states of mind. Right now we're secluded, drawn away. We've done our preliminary work. Quite secluded from unwholesome states of mind. We apply thought and we sustain the thought on our object of meditation. If it's on the fan, it doesn't mean that I don't hear the car. I don't hear somebody rustling. I don't detect my heartbeat. Doesn't mean that I don't feel that itch It's just all of those things are in my peripheral vision or my peripheral knowing, but I'm focusing on one thing. That is the application of thought. Sustained thought means I stick with it. How do you stick with something? You have to investigate it. You have to engage with it. You have to become active with it. So if it's the breath, I might notice if the air is cool or warm when I inhale. Is it cool or warm when I exhale? Just noticing the characteristics of the breath. Do I take long breaths or do I take short breaths? Or is my inhalation longer or shorter than my exhalation? Just noticing these things about the breath. Investigate. I might wonder if the breath is smooth or whether it's choppy. Just noticing the characteristics of the breath. If I'm following the intermittent sound of the vehicles, I might wonder, is that a sports car or is that a truck? The rumble. Was it heavy? Was it deep? I might wonder, is it a fine-tuned, maybe late-model vehicle, or an old one on its last leg? I'm investigating the sound of that vehicle. Does it have a clang, 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 clang? Or what kind of sound is it exactly that I'm listening to? I'm engaged with my object. And the longer I engage with the object, I find that I'm not separate from the object. I start to meld, come together with it, become unified with the object. If a thought enters my mind that's not concerning the object, I know I lost some concentration, and so a stray thought ran in. I bring my focus and attention back to the object. This engagement keeps me ardently aware, alert, yet I become more and more concentrated and more still. And at some point when the stillness has reached its perfect level for the moment, there's a little feeling of happiness. I'm settled. I'm still. I'm steady. So there is that happiness. He calls it rapture and pleasure born of the attainment. So that's the first level. And then the second level is at some point you drop off the apply because you're sticking with it. You're right there with it. You're right there with it. So no need to apply attention. Just sustaining attention. But then at some point there's the falling away and of the sustained attention because you've merged with it. It's just a feeling of oneness, of unification of mind. It's the next level. So no need to stay. Sustained is too gross. You just are like one with it. And then the sort of happiness that you felt, realizing you've reached a still point, a steady point inside, that becomes too gross. And it drops away. And you feel more of a pleasure born of bliss. And the difference between that happiness and that bliss is like being on a desert and seeing an oasis. The happiness is kind of active. It's a little bit exciting, you know. Like, it's not that I'm going to get water. I'm going to find water. I see water. It's in my view. Because that kind of happiness starts to bubble up. But then even that becomes too rough. So the bliss is like once you've taken a lap and sipped the water. It's a different kind, a very settled kind of content. And then you can stay in there, in that space, as long as it stays. And if you are successful in abiding in that place, after a while, that contentment even falls away. And you're in a place of equanimity, where it's not necessary to be content or discontent. It's all the same. It's like really nothing. We just erased the whole board. Now we can create. So things will arise. We look at how they arise. And before they told us how to feel, how to look at, how to experience something. But now, sitting in this pure land, this nibbana here and now, we begin to see things as we are. And it changes. This is one practice. If that one doesn't work for you, you got bunches of others. You know? But that is one. And that's the easy one. And it's one you can start with and you can work 5 minutes at it. You know, you don't even have to go long. It's like no torture. I said 30 minutes and I'm going to sit for 30 minutes. You know, but when you experience these stages, and your time is up because you gave yourself 5 minutes or 10 minutes, you look forward to the next time you come and do it. The next time you sit. Oh, when I get home tonight, I'm going to sit again. You know, it's like that. No force, no pressing, but just enjoying it. And before you know it, you'll be able to sit longer and longer and longer. And then sometimes you don't have longer, so you can't go through that whole thing. You know, so you practice until you get so good at it that when I have to go in, I sit and there. That's it. You know, I understood what John Manley said one day, you know, said he was summoned to get immediately in the Spirit, and immediately he was in the Spirit. It's just like that. You can just switch from here to here. That's the self-mastery. And that's what you working towards. That's the first level of attainment. When we can see the impermanence of things and fully accept, not be moved. We can see that none of it is self, or that there's any permanent, abiding, inherently existing self in anything. And we're no longer afraid of things changing. He says, and when you've done this, you've entered the first step of enlightenment, the first, you've entered the stream. Now, when you step into a stream, and I'm through, when you step into a stream, you know, it's like kind of muddy on the banks. You got to be careful because the little sticks and stuff stick in your feet, broken shells and stuff like that. Fish scales. So it's a little fraught. A little bit of danger when you step right there. Sometimes it just doesn't feel so good, you know. But as you move on out into the water, it's a little bit different. And when you're on the edge and you pick your foot up, it's like having, almost like you have to, you know, get it up because it sinks down into the mud. Or if you're on the ocean front, it sinks down into the sand when the water starts covering your feet and rolls away. But the further out you go, the more buoyant you become. The further out you go, the more the pull of the water carries you. And so that's why we're called stream enterers. When we start, if we wade on out into the stream, he said, and you don't have to worry, because if you get out there, the stream will carry you. He said, just and the stream will take you where you want to go. So, I've enjoyed being with you today. If you have any questions about anything, I'd be happy to try to answer. If you have any questions about your personal practice, and you haven't been able to get an answer, feel free to talk about it.